stomped your feet.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Billy Joe. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Billy Joe.
And I'm really nervous because I want to carry a message and not a mess. And at 32 years sober, this time, this is my second try at sobriety, I want to be an example of why somebody from Florida would send flowers. And so I didn't know that was going to happen, and I'm in tears because there are people in this room who saw me 35 years ago when I first came to these meetings. And that's so important for me to stay in Benicia for my history here. You're my history. And so there's just something very special about this small fellowship. We're just a small town. And here in California, this small fellowship is kind of an oddity, if you will. And I hated it when I first got in here because people knew me, you know, and they remembered what I said. And it was like, oh, God, you know. And that's part of my story. So I'm Billy Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date this time is February 16th, 1992. And yes, I had to have it tattooed on me because in case I ever forgot that I was an alcoholic, I wanted this to be my visual reminder. I have a sponsor and she knows she's my sponsor. And she has a sponsor and her sponsor has a sponsor. And the grand sponsor knows me too. So very important to have that accountability of sponsorship. I am so nervous. My home group is the Thursday night, 8 o'clock Hilltop meeting. We call it the popcorn meeting. And the reason we call it the popcorn meeting is for in memory of our beloved Tinker. Now, when I was her age, or when I was when I came into AA, I was 27, but Tinker was the age that I am now, and I thought she was an old lady. And so now here I am going, oh my God, I'm the age that Tinker was. So Tinker was this biker chick, grandma, and she would throw these pink and blue baskets all over the room and say, get your ass to a meeting no matter what. And she'd throw these pink and blue baskets around, pink for the girls and blue for the boys. And we always came to meetings hungry, and so she brought some popcorn. And that just turned into this thing, and that's how the Thursday night, 8 o'clock, my home group got the name of the popcorn meeting. So that is in a memory of our beloved Tinker. She was a character, and what's funny is now her daughter comes to meetings here. So it's like full circle. So I first started attending meetings in Contra Costa County in September of 87, and then I moved to Solano County in Benicia, and there were only two meetings a week here. There was the Thursday night, 8 o'clock, my home group, and there was Sunday night at 8 o'clock at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. So only two nights a week were a meeting. When I was born, my name is Billy Joe. When I was born, my parents thought I'd be a boy, and they already had the name of Billy Joe picked out. Surprise, it's a girl. So they changed the spelling of my name, and I came out fighting God or anyone who told me what to do, or that I couldn't do something and that I was a girl. You can't do this, you're a girl. You can't do that, you're a girl. Oh, really? You should never have named me Billy Joe. So I came out a fighter. That's just it, you know, fight or flight. I remember taking psychology classes and asking the lady that was the professor there, why am I like this? She goes, you got a lot of fight in you. Proved to be a good thing for me later in life. I saw signs of God's existence throughout my life, but I did the best I could to ignore him or push him away because I did not need any help. Thank you very much. I absolutely did not want any help of any kind, and I was convinced that God did not love me. He only loved people like the Pope or people that go to church. God only loved people who didn't lie or steal. And I was a liar, a con artist, a thief, a cheat. I lied so easily that it came very naturally. Why do I lie? Because whatever I was saying needed to sound more exciting than it actually was. I never knew what was going to come out of my mouth, and neither did you. I piled lies on top of lies. I lied even when it would have been just as easy to tell the truth. And it never occurred to me that maybe others knew that I was lying. Never occurred to me. My mom was extremely controlling. So I rebelled against her for everything. Mom was God at that time in my life. I was the kid who got spanked every single day. The Board of Education. So, not just got in trouble. I got spanked every single day with the board. Mom would say, "Don't touch that, Billy Joe." And of course, Billy Joe touched it. Usually hit it, broke it, did something. So I don't know what it is about me, but you know, don't do that. Well, fuck you. I'm going to go do it anyway. At age 11, I experienced my first drink, and up until the age of 11, everybody was drinking beer in our house. Dad was a mechanic and a firefighter and a motorcyclist, and so there was always beer, and I was the kid that would go to the refrigerator and get the beer, pop it open, and get the first sip. And so prior to age 11, I was already a beer drinker. But at the age of 11, something happened, and that was my best friend, Kim. She lived one door down from me. She and I were unsupervised, minors unsupervised, oh boy. She had the audacity to go into her parents' liquor cabinet, and I'll never forget her putting those bottles. Oh, those bottles look like magic, by the way. The colors, the ember, oh my God, the labels, wow. And I'm like, wow, how do you have the balls to do that? She got two little cups and she poured a little bit out of each bottle into these two cups. And then she went to the faucet and she marked with a pen exactly where the lines were, and she replaced the alcohol with the water. I'm watching all this going, wow, something that I didn't think of, because normally I'm the troublemaker. And this was really exciting to watch somebody else. And I thought, man, she is going to get her butt beat. Kim is my best friend. She gets me. And we are soulmates. And I put this liquid to my lips, and it is just god-awful burning sensation. And I thought, oh, I thought she loved me. And I felt betrayed. Like, how could you make me drink rat poison? You know, it was horrible. And it was really bad when it got right here. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to have a heart attack and die. But something happened between here and here. And by the time it reached here, my eyes opened wide, and to my astonishment, I loved it. It didn't burn anymore. So the second and third and fourth sip didn't burn anymore, and I had my first alcoholic drink. I liked the way it made me feel, and I wanted more. I fought that first time drunk with that ease and comfort for decades. I knew I needed and wanted that feeling from then on. I did not party until I was 16. It was 1976 and I had a car. Freedom! But I got caught the first time out and had my wheels taken away. What a sick hangover that was. That should have been my first sign. Even sadder, it was my first blackout drunk. So from then on, I learned to be sneaky and not get caught. Getting caught was a smokescreen and another form of lying. My sister informed me later in life that my parents and her would lay in bed at night when I came home, when I finally came home. And we had this very long hallway, and they would count how many times I bumped into the walls. So Sneaky Billy, the typical drunk, thought if I got on my hands and knees and crawled to my bedroom. And my sister said the head hitting the wall was even louder than my shoulder hitting the wall. So they could always tell how hungover I'd be the next day by how many times I bumped in the hallway. So I'm a blackout drunk before I turn 21. My drinking was beginning to cause me problems now. I have not shared this part of my story. I usually embellish my story and talk about motorcycles and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so this is why I think I'm nervous, is because I'm telling on myself for the first time. And 32 years into this program, it's about time. So no more smoke screens. Here's the real deal. I am a liar. I'm a drunk. I'm a thief. I'm a blackout drunk. And I'm not pretty. You don't smell good and look good when you're like me. My drinking was beginning to cause me problems now. I started getting pulled over now by the police. But my dad's a firefighter, for Contra Costa Consolidated, and all the police officers hang out with the fire department at the firehouse. So those are all my dad's friends, and they're all drunks too. So what they do is they pour out my alcohol and give me a lecture, trying to shame and blame me. I don't remember you. I'm a blackout drunk. So half the time I didn't remember getting pulled over. I just thought, wow, I really drank a lot tonight. Because I'm in a blackout. I don't remember things. Hangovers and blackouts are not, and now, so hangovers were getting really bad, blackouts every single time, and now friends are leaving me, and my drinking is beginning to take a toll. So I've gone from being the most popular, the social butterfly with the badass 69 Chevy, and racing, now people are starting to leave my life. The look good has gone. My consequences are that I lied so much that I was getting caught more and more. I can no longer remember who I told what to. Now people are becoming more difficult to get along with, and fighting is happening. Waking up sore with bruises all over after a night of blacking out is confusing. I don't even like myself anymore. So no wonder God doesn't love me. And my friends are leaving my life. I am waking up with strange men now. I don't know who they are the next day. I don't know where I am, and I don't know where my car is. Incomprehensible demoralization is hanging out in a limo after meeting some rock stars at a club, and I had to pee. So the limo pulls over, and I go right in front of the limo in an alley, and I'm peeing with the spotlight of the headlights on me. How sexy is that? So my lower panions, of course, were right next to me. I remember I no longer had the friends that I had when I started. I have my lower companion friends, the ones that do drugs now. They're as low bottom drunks as I am. The other ones don't want anything to do with me anymore. So I'm in an alley. My lower companions are right next to me. And my new best friends are now able to drink more than me and are egging me on to act more foolish than I already do. And now the guys are starting to like them more than me. I was always the popular one. I was always the one the guys wanted to talk to. But now I don't have that anymore. I don't have that smooth talking, fun girl to be around anymore. So I may be a drunk, and I may be in a blackout, but I'm not stupid. These girls are taking my men, and I'm not liking it. So now I'm turning into a mean, mad drunk. I went from being that, oh, everything's groovy, peace, love, and hippiness, and now I'm just the pissed off and slamming doors and I'll show you, and I walk off from a party and go walking someplace, and it's like, yeah, boy, you showed them all right. Now you don't know where you are. Cussing is now my only language, because cussing is the only thing I know, because I'm mad as hell. I am no longer a very nice person and hard to be around. I hardly know who I am anymore, and the self-loathing is always how I feel. Even if I had a good day, I remember looking in the mirror and having that self-loathing. I swear to drink only 2 drinks now every time I go out, and I did. I would practice it. I'd look in the mirror and, you're only going to have 2 drinks tonight. Tonight is only going to be 2 drinks. And yet every single time I drank too much, I hit that mark, I go overboard, and I'm blacked out again. So by the age of 27, I am done. My life just isn't working anymore, and it's not worth living anymore. As I begin making a plan for my suicide, I start writing a journal to my ex-husband so that he can raise our 2-year-old son, Tyler. I love my son with my whole heart, and leaving him was the hardest thing I'd ever plan on doing. But I couldn't figure out how to live and raise him and be the drunk that I was. How am I going to do this and when? The ease and comfort of alcohol have left me. Alcohol stopped working for me. It turned on me like one day to the next. I've reached my all-time rock bottom, utterly exhausted from fighting and the insanity that comes with it. During my suicide plan, I got a call, and my cousin Kathy has shot herself. It's 1987, and my cousin Kathy is gay. We don't talk about it, just that she has lots of friends, never any boyfriends, And what happened was Kathy came home and she was in a relationship with her wife, her spouse, and she found her wife in bed with another woman. So in August of 87, our family does not speak of what is real, like being gay, and I attend Kathy's funeral and see what suicide does to my family. The utter devastation this death causes, and again, our family doesn't talk. We don't talk about it. And our uncles began to deflect the truth and feel she was murdered. And so that took away from the fact that this happened. Now we're going to focus on it, somebody else's fault. It's kind of funny because I always thought I was the one that could deflect so well, and it turns out it's just a family trait. Kind of funny. My poor cousin felt that suicide was an option, and infidelity sent her over the edge, and she didn't have anybody that she could talk to. So now I'm the person that I just can't live anymore. And so now, great, suicide is no longer an option for me, and neither is alcohol. Here I am at my rock bottom. I was taken to my first AA meeting by a guy I was dating. I did not know that AA even existed. I had never known anyone who had gone to a meeting, let alone actually stopped drinking. Like, that's not possible. Not drinking had never been an idea or a thought. What is this AA thing? I had never thought of another person or of being of service to others. I actually thought AA could teach me to drink like a lady. Boy, was I wrong. So I talked your AA language and I attended your meetings. However, working these steps with another woman and the whole God thing was not something I could do. So for 4.5 years, I had no God. I had no higher power. I'm still clueless and miserable, and it's 1992, and the Kim, the childhood best friend that I drank with at age 11, has just died in a single car drunk driving accident. And she's left her 2 daughters. They're 3 and 5. So great. Cousin's dead. She killed herself. Kim, drunk driving, and she's dead. She had the cruise control on, blacked out, and ended up in a field. And it was the week before her brother's wedding. So all the relatives were in town, and she wasn't found for 4 days. So at first she was MIA, which as an alcoholic, we do that. We have a tendency to run away. And so everybody was really mad at Kim because they thought she'd run away and was trying to get attention taken away from her brother's wedding. Turns out she was in a field in Vacaville dead in her car. The only good news about that is she did die instantly. So now I have suicide and I have a car accident. So that, and you're at your rock bottom, the incomprehensible demoralization, I may as well get it tattooed on me because I can describe it to a T. So suicide's no longer an option for me, and relapse is imminent. I was so mad at this guy named JJ at my home group. He told me really honest things like, take the cotton out of ears and stick it in your mouth. First 90 days, don't speak. You have nothing to say. They did not coddle you in the 80s, okay? If I said that to one of my sponsees today, holy crap. Yeah, I just lost a sponsee the other day due to me telling her the truth, so yeah. So you have nothing to say, Billy Joe, because you're a dry drunk. Get a higher power. Call him God. Oh, did he piss me off, this JJ. I came home from that Thursday night meeting, my home group, and I stopped at Safeway. We didn't have Raley's yet. And I said, well, JJ, I'll just show you. And so for 2 weeks, I sat at home trying to drink at JJ because I'm so mad at him. And I couldn't even get a buzz. Turns out JJ was telling me the truth. There's nothing worse than having attended meetings for 4.5 years and you're hearing JJ's voice and Tinker and all these other people. And you're trying to get a buzz and you can't. So the next Thursday night, after these 2 weeks, I fully intended to go to the Thursday night Hilltop popcorn meeting and tell JJ off. And it was going to be the F word too. I was going to use the big word. But his words kept repeating in my head over and over again. I walk into the room, and instead of telling him off, I raise my hand as a newcomer. The preamble used to be so profound for me because they said that those who cannot be honest are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves and others. So I thought I was mentally ill and that I was constitutionally incapable. And so all of a sudden my hand is up when they said, are there any newcomers? Now I'm there to tell JJ to go F off. But my hand is up and I looked around and there was nobody in the kitchen with me. So I had raised my hand. And that raising of my hand was the first time ever admitting to myself and to another alcoholic that I was an alcoholic. So how and who raised my hand? God did it. I looked at my hand like, who did that? I had finally admitted to God, myself, and the whole meeting that I was an alcoholic and needed help. So that's why February 16th, 1992, that I have tattooed on my arm, is my second sobriety date, and I can honestly say that I have done everything that is suggested. I go to meetings, I call my sponsor, I work my steps, I'm of service to others. I am of service to my home group. I reach out. I pretended or acted as if I believed in a greater power than myself. I listened to those old timers like my beloved JJ, and I faked it till I made it, until at 9 years sober, March 23rd, 2001, is the day that I got a new realization. I was on my motorcycle brother's Harley. I was in Fairfield and I was going to go to the Vacaville Harley dealership to show them that I could ride because they wouldn't let me test drive a full dresser. So I went on a Heritage, and it is my motorcycle brother who's a clean and sober brother. So I get on his bike and I ride through an intersection and a little old lady T-bones me. And instead of stopping, she drug me under the bike, under the car, and I died at the scene. I remember when it happened, I was rolling and it was very, very painful. And the first thing that came out of my mouth when I stopped rolling and everything's on top of me, the first thing I said was, God, I need you and I need you now. And then I went to this beautiful field and there was no pain. And it wasn't too hot and it wasn't too cold. I have a real big thing about being too hot and too cold. I'm really weird when it comes to that. And this place was gorgeous. The light wasn't too bright. It was really nice there. And that pain that I just felt was actually my leg. I had a little bit of skin keeping my foot on. And so I had a partial amputation at the scene, and that's why I was in so much pain. And so I'm at this light, and there's this beautiful willow tree, and there's this field of wildflowers, and I'm laying in this carpeted wildflowers, and the temperature is perfect. And then I feel somebody right next to me, and I'm like, oh, shit. And I wasn't about to look at him. I knew who it was, and the first thing that he said to me was, I'm not the one that keeps leaving you, Billy Joe. You keep leaving me. And I like to argue, and I couldn't argue. And I remember laying there thinking, yeah, you're right. I keep leaving you, God. Who's standing next to me. God, I do not want to know if you have blonde hair, blue eyes, if you have dark hair. I am not going to look at you. If I don't look at you, something about that looking at him. So I'm still fighting, you know. Okay, that was the truth. Why am I not at the beach? You know, typical alcoholic. I'm in paradise right now and talking to God, but I think that should be another way. So, trying to rearrange the damn lights on the stage, you know. Why am I not at the beach? I gotta have something to bitch about. The next thing he tells me, after all this self-loathing and all this incomprehensible demoralization, is he says, I love you unconditionally. And it went through me like a bolt of lightning. And I still feel it right now. So 22 years later, I guess 23 years later now, I still feel his love unconditionally. And so I don't walk around going, is there a God or isn't there a God? Oh, hell no. He is alive, kicking, and I don't know what he looks like because I wouldn't look. But he loves me. Holy crap, he loves me. It was profound. It was a very profound feeling, and I thought, well, cool. I'm going to see my mom now. And where are my dogs, you know? But that's not what happened. Instead, he said, the final thing that he said to me was, I'm not done with you yet. And the next thing I know, I'm drug under the bike again. I mean, literally, the accident is happening a second time, only this time I'm looking at some highway patrol officer who has a can of orange spray paint, and I work for Cal OSHA, so I know that means fatality. And he's spray painting, and I said, get that orange spray can away from me. And he got my butt crack with orange spray paint. I had it for months. And he jumped back. And I remember somebody was playing Rice Krispies with my ribs, and the paramedic stopped. Everybody just stopped, but they wouldn't look me in the eye. I thought, that's kind of weird. And I said, the first thing that came out of my mouth was, I want to go back to the light. And the paramedic said, sorry, honey, today's not your day. So I got a free ride in a helicopter, and I recovered from a life-threatening injury. I had 15 surgeries to save my foot. I learned to walk again. Turns out that fighter in me, that fight or flight, came in a little handy. I was 40 years old, got the crap knocked out of me, found God, and my sobriety has been a little bit easier ever since. Because I don't hate Billy Joe anymore. There are times that I go, ugh. But still. And so in celebration of working my steps with my sponsor, I'm going to talk about the steps next. But this year I did something a little different. 2 years ago I had gastric bypass surgery and I've lost some weight. So there's some people in here that remember when I was a little fluffy. I went from really skinny at 27, got older, and we call this aging in AA. And then I got fat because I found food. And food was my next addiction. And so now I'm working my steps on that addiction about food, and I've kept the weight off for 2 years. And that's because I like myself now. And I like myself a lot more with less weight. My foot feels better too. I'm still disabled because of that accident, but I get around a lot better now. So as a result of getting sober, I started working the steps, and the first step tells me that I'm powerless over alcohol. Boy, howdy. Every single time I tried to go out and have those two drinks, missed the mark, blackout drunk. So who was I fooling thinking I could handle my drinking? I was only fooling myself. That's that part of lying and cheating yourself. You know, you come to that line and you either do it or you stay on this side of the line and stay sober. So every time I crossed that line, I was cheating myself. I wasn't cheating you. You probably already knew the truth that I was lying to you anyway. So step two had me come to believe. And when God gave me the message that he gave me, that he loves me unconditionally, and I quickly asked God to help me, this restored my faith in God. This restored my faith that there is a higher power. I had a hard time calling him God right away. I did not come out of that and go into the hospital and say, God really exists. I called him HP, higher power, because it sounded like HD, Harley Davidson. So I had to kindly, the softer way of getting into saying God. So today I say God, which is dog spelled backwards, just so you know. So step three, I had to turn everything over to God. And what a relief. Oh, I'm not in control? I can't change the weather. I can't change your mind about what you're going to do. So, great. I'll just turn it over to God. It's fruitless to fight anything or anyone, and it just leaves me feeling resentful and angry and tired and exhausted. So, recently what happened with my sister, I'm sticking to emails with my sister. I have a contentious relationship with my sister. She is now the executrix of the estate. My stepmother died tragically a few weeks ago. And my trigger is my sister. I go back to that same stupid little girl, ugly little girl. And that's not going to happen this time because I am Billy today. I have 32 years sober. And she may not know what that means, but I know what it means. And so by me sticking to emails with my sister and not engaging in the toxicity of our relationship, I'll just walk past that dog pile and I'll just give it up to God. Now remind me that I'm going to October. I'm going to Idaho to get my stuff from my dad on October 14th. And I'm really wrapped tight about it. And I'm very anxious about it. And it's really hard for me to live in the moment. It's been tough getting through the stress of today because I said yes to today before my stepmom died. So I'll be glad when I'm done talking here because this is just hard for me to tell the truth. And the fact that I'm telling the truth right before I'm going to go see my sister. So there's something very profound that happens when you get up here. First, the profoundness of writing your stuff down. Don't cheat yourself. Write this stuff down. You know, oh, I've read the book a million times. Yeah, well, write it down. You'll be doing yourself a big favor. For me, it's magic. And then to get up here and say it in front of my friends, you guys are my family that I've chosen. You're the chosen ones. So step four was a huge saving grace for me by writing my resentments. This leads into my fear-based step four. When did I become so fear-based? In step four, I found out that every person that pissed me off that ended up on my resentments list, when it came back to what did I do, where was I responsible, it turned out, well, I said that to her because I was afraid she'd reject me first. When did I become so fearful? I acted like a badass my entire life, and yet I'm scared. But I couldn't let you know that. So my very, very first four step that I did, I actually thought you guys were going to throw me in jail. But see, I didn't have a higher power, so I didn't realize you guys weren't the popo. So, and I say that lovingly because I worked for the Department of Corrections, so I was the popo. Step five was the first time I'd ever been honest with myself, and so thankfully the preamble about those who are unable to be honest are constitutionally incapable. Turns out I am constitutionally capable of being honest with myself and others. And so God and my sponsor are the ones that get to hear me on my step five. And that's the first time that I've had that sense of belonging to someone else by telling my sponsor what's real. I usually walk into a room and go, oh, look, those two people are connected. Oh, those three like each other. And I feel that spotlight is on me. Oddball, weirdo, walking into room, house wrecker. Yeah, I don't feel that anymore now because instead, I go, yeah, he's right there, that God that I wouldn't look at. So step six helped me to realize I'm really ready to remove these defects of character. Yeah, let's get rid of these. Yeah, I'm ready. Ready. Thank you, God. And step seven tells me that I'm humbly asking him to remove these. They don't work for me anymore. Can you help me with this, God? I really want to get rid of this crap. Because this crap's been bogging me down for a really long time. Step eight was really easy because I just look at my list from step four. And I couldn't wait to get rid of the stuff. And myself was the first on the list. Step eight confused me at first because I thought, well, wait a minute. I already wrote this stuff down. And what step eight I figured out after the sponsor helped me was I was going to make direct amends. And that shocked my friends who listened. And the first time I made amends, maybe they didn't call me again. Maybe they still didn't trust me. But 32 years into this program, usually the amends that I make are somebody that, well, I'll give you an example. My best friend, Becky. Becky came into my life in the 90s, and we stayed solid for decades. And then we had an outing 10 years ago. And in January of this year, she wrote a letter. She brought it to Starbucks and she read me a letter of amends. And Becky made a very emotional amends to me. And Becky is my best friend again. And I trust her and she trusts me. And I have to tell you, fixing a friendship that got that broken, that had never been offered to me. Yes, I've had fights with John Stanton, who used to come to meetings and piss me off. I'd fix things like that. There was this one guy, oh my God, him in his yellow rain jacket back in the 90s. And so I'd had cases of broken friendships that had gotten fixed. But with Becky and I, it's the first time that I've gotten to move from the pain to the acceptance to now we're enjoying each other's company again. And it's a whole nother level. It's a whole nother level. Yeah. So step 10 was my awareness and a way to make amends immediately. For me, step 10 is me every day, me standing here right now. As far as I know, unless I listen to the tape later, I have not said any lies to you today. And that's huge for this alcoholic. Huge. Huge. I'll be able to remember what I told you yesterday. And tomorrow I'll be able to say, yeah, that happened. Then that's big for someone who carried elaborate lies on for a really long time. My step 11, I pray constantly. I have this connection. Like I said, he's right there with me. And I pray constantly and I enjoy my connection to God very much. And that helps me stay connected to you, to others. I do my meditation because that helps me slow down. I'm so full of anxiety still. I'm not really sure. I'm sure more will be revealed. You know, we peel the layers of the onion. The anxiety's been getting the best of me this year. And so more meditation is required. And my step 12 is me coming to meetings, spending time with my sponsees, spending time with my sponsor, telling her the truth. Being a part of the fellowship here in Benicia, it's so funny. The other day I asked this gal, she'd been coming for maybe a couple months, and I said, did I greet you a couple months ago? She goes, oh, hell yes. You rolled out the red carpet. I was really worried that I hadn't been friendly to her yet. And she goes, God, you're so obnoxious. For 2 months I've had to put up with you saying, hi, welcome. And I'm like, so a little overboard? And she goes, yeah, if you could just tone it down a little bit. She says, I'm used to you now at 2 months, but I'm so afraid someone new is going to walk in the doors and I don't greet them. So yeah, I'm a little inquisitive. Hi, who are you? Where are you from? Are you new here? There's a reason behind it. I'm not going to ignore you. I'm not going to walk past you. Just in church the other day. Oh, I joined a church. That's pretty amazing. Just the other day in church, the pastor was talking about this homeless guy walks into this church. You know, someplace like San Francisco, really big, like 300 people. We have 30 people in our church. So this is like our church size right here. You notice when somebody comes in. This guy came in. He's got the long, scraggly hair. And he's sitting in the back and not one person talked to him. And then everybody does all their little stuff. And then it's time for the pastor to get up and preach the sermon. And this homeless guy takes off his beanie, takes off his jacket. He's got a nice suit on and he goes up and he goes, so you guys don't welcome newcomers here very well. And he says, so you know what? I'm going to pray for all of you and I'll see you next Sunday. And he came the next Sunday and preached. And of course, the congregation sat there going, oh my God, we didn't pass that test. Well, Billy Joe wants to make sure I pass that test and you get welcomed. And so welcome. For all of you who are aging with me in AA, thank you. We're doing it gracefully. We're rocking it out of the ballpark. But when you come to a program at 27 and you're still hip, slick, and cool and all your body parts still work, then you stick around for 35 years. Holy crap, I'm 64 years old. I didn't expect to live this long. But what a privilege. What a privilege that I didn't die 23 years ago. So there's something out there that I'm still supposed to do. And it could be that now that I'm Aiden's grandma, that might be what I was supposed to stay alive for, was to be Aiden's grandma. And thank you, God, for giving me my grandson. Thank you.
Another big hand for